During the 1992 presidential campaign, the winning side kept focused with a sign that read, "It's the economy, stupid." Today, the housing slowdown and credit crunch have the economy front and center once again. Our special guest today is uniquely qualified to talk about the economy. Dennis Lockhart, as you know, is president and chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. He works with Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke to set benchmark rates that influence other interest rates and regulates the amount of available credit. Dennis represents the 6th District, headquartered in Atlanta. The district includes Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That region generates $1.7 trillion in economic output. So if the 6th District were a nation, its economy would rank as 8th largest in the world, between Italy and Canada. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dennis Lockhart.
Well, Mark, thank you very much, and thanks to the Atlanta Press Club for giving me this opportunity to speak and for inviting me here today in these challenging times for national economic policy. This is my second move to Atlanta. I arrived in March, and the first move to Atlanta was in the summer of 1978. I was actually moving here from Tehran, Iran, of all places, and my wife and I came and found a vibrant and very welcoming city, and I see some old friends here in the audience, a city that deserved the title Capital of the New South. My wife, who's now deceased, was a Southerner, and she was excited about coming to the South and coming to Atlanta. I had actually grown up in California, and I viewed it as a new adventure to learn about a new part of the country. This week, on the 9th of September, would be our 35th wedding anniversary, and part of my affection for this place and for the South in general really derives from the many great years that I spent with my wife, including 10 years here in Atlanta. She was, as many Southerners are, a great storyteller. And I remember many amusing stories about her upbringing, particularly in Virginia. But one story that comes from her college years seems to fit our current circumstances. She attended Hollins College in Roanoke, Virginia. Any Hollins grads in the audience? Usually there are. And she took an art history course from a professor she described as brilliant, passionate about art, but a little bit odd in his dress and mannerisms, and especially some of his phraseology. We all have a mental image of this kind of professor, you know, probably a little bit tattered in a tweedy coat and so forth, and a bit eccentric. And when the time came for the final exam for the course, he passed out a sheet with this very concise assignment. The exam read, after the visual feast comes the dyspeptic sequelae. Discuss. Now, I know in this audience there are men and women of letters, so I probably don't need to translate the Latin, but the phrase refers to indigestion and the discomfort, or even worse than the discomfort, that we sometimes feel after a big meal. Perhaps seems an apt way to describe the conditions today in the housing sector and in the debt capital markets. Dyspeptic sequelae. So this afternoon, I'm going to discuss recent events in the housing and capital markets, and I'll also share with you some principles as a new Federal Reserve Bank president that I use to help guide my thinking on Federal Reserve actions in times like these. Since I became Atlanta Fed president in March, I have devoted particular attention to the sharp and persistent downturn in the housing sector, both nationally and in the Southeast. For instance, the nation's inventory of new homes for sale has increased sharply this year and is now almost 8 months' supply at current at the current pace of sales. Housing permits in July declined nationally by around 24% from a year earlier. The problems with housing are also evident in housing finance, the mortgage market. And I know you all are very well aware of the subprime mortgage market, the epicenter of recent turmoil in financial markets. Let me provide a little bit of background. Our nation has more than $10 trillion of mortgage debt. About 60% of that is securitized. In other words, these individual mortgages are no longer held as assets of the banks or the other mortgage originators, but have been pooled. The pools have been structured as securities that have been sold and traded in a vast and growing global market for these securities. Buyers have included structured investment vehicles, you'll hear that term a lot these days, SIVs, fully or partially devoted to subprime mortgage securities, money market funds, hedge funds, banks, including foreign banks, insurance companies, thanks to AIG for your sponsorship today, pension funds, I hope your subprime portfolio is under control, pension funds, and other investment funds. Exposure to the U.S. mortgage market has been distributed globally, and in fact, we don't know exactly where all this exposure to this class of security rests. The linkages are complex, but here is my synopsis of recent market turmoil. Since mid-2006, home price appreciation slowed, and recent prices have fallen in some markets. Earlier in 2007, the markets perceived the subprime mortgage credit quality was deteriorating markedly. Delinquencies among subprime borrowers have been rising and are expected to continue to rise, and many borrowers are experiencing difficulty refinancing. The initial low rates on their adjustable rate mortgages are resetting to higher rates that imply much higher monthly payments. At the same time, stagnant housing prices have eliminated their option of refinancing at lower rates or selling their house at a profit. The spike in delinquencies has affected not only the mortgage holders, but also other segments of the financial markets, including the market for asset-backed commercial paper. As background, the commercial paper market links investors directly with corporate borrowers, without the intervention or without the intermediation of banks. About half the commercial paper market is so-called SIVs, structured investment vehicles, that invest in financial assets. Holders of the asset-backed commercial paper obligations of SIVs came to recognize the increased risk and in many cases refused to roll over or refinance the short-term debt of these borrowers. In turn, the securities that included significant amounts of subprime mortgages became hard to value. The secondary market for these securities shrank dramatically. I describe this development as something of a closed loop. Valuation uncertainty reduced the secondary market trading. Little or no trading made it even more difficult or impossible to value the securities at market price. Faced with these valuation difficulties, broader market participants have become wary of classes of structured debt securities beyond the subprime asset class. For instance, the markets for jumbo prime mortgages also experienced some liquidity problems. Investment funds believed to be heavily exposed to subprime mortgage securities and other structured debt securities have faced some redemptions and cancellation of borrowing facilities used to acquire the securities in the first place. This development forced sales of other classes of securities in their portfolios and institutional sponsors of these investment funds have been called upon to support their distressed funds. Many investment funds bought these securities on margin, that is, using debt, and this fact is very important. By employing leverage, many funds pursued enhanced returns, and efforts by investment funds to improve their liquidity and reduce exposure to risky assets involved reducing the amount of outstanding debt. This process, called deleveraging, appears to be widespread currently across the financial system. The recoiling from risk in general is affecting an unrelated market, and that is the leveraged loan market used by private equity deal sponsors. This market has backed up markedly. Loan commitments intended to be syndicated have not been able to close because of weak distribution prospects. By some estimates, more than $400 billion of such financings are in backlog. Equity markets have experienced increased volatility, and at least that is in part due to an increasingly uncertain environment for corporate earnings and the stalling of buyout activity. The current conditions of the capital markets, particularly the debt capital markets, have been described as a credit crunch, a liquidity squeeze becoming a solvency crisis, a crisis of information, and a repricing of risk. I'd like to comment on two of these interpretations, namely the information deficit and the repricing of risk. The markets are indeed experiencing a significant information deficit. Market participants are struggling to discover the true performance of subprime pools, where exposures to these and other structured instruments ultimately rests, the risk, therefore, associated with trading and borrowing counterparties, and the linkage between asset classes, funding markets, and institution-to-institution exposures. The opaque nature of our current financial world is the result of a long trend of replacing direct bank lending with less transparent investment vehicles in securities markets. In coming weeks, we will see more disclosure of gains and losses on exposure, as well as performance trends of portfolios and securities, but very importantly, I believe clarity will take some time to develop. Second, in my view, we're witnessing more than just a repricing of risk. The credit markets of recent years feasted on a low cost of capital through leverage investing and aggressive financing structures at both the retail and the wholesale level. I believe we're also seeing a broad retreat from higher risk practices. Practices, just to name a few, such as no documentation, no equity mortgages, covenant light leverage buyouts, and the so-called carry trade, which is borrowing in one currency to invest unhedged in the debt instruments of another currency. These are just examples of some of the practices. I believe we've been experiencing the unpleasant process of the financial world changing its ways after a prolonged period of relatively cheap and available credit and, in consequence, high leverage. What we've been going through is an intense adjustment in both price and practice, and this process is likely to continue. How did all this come about? Underlying these developments was a financial world awash with liquidity, awash with funds looking for a place to be invested. Low interest rates were a worldwide phenomenon during and after the 2001 recession. Despite many central banks raising short-term rates since 2004, long-term rates have remained relatively low. Low rates, combined with ample liquidity provided by a globally integrated capital market, provided an environment for financial innovation. We also saw aggressive practices and the use of leverage, as I mentioned a moment ago. Until a few weeks ago, liquidity conditions continued, good liquidity conditions continued, and the outlook was good on balance. Global growth was and remains strong, and after a weak first quarter, U.S. growth was expected to rebound strongly in the second quarter, which in fact it did. This is what occurred. With the exception of declines in housing-related industries such as construction, building supplies, and recently mortgage servicing, employment growth overall was well maintained through the first half of the year. The unemployment rate in July was 4.6%. Consumer spending remained strong, and business investment during the second quarter picked up momentum. The one serious negative aspect was and remains the housing sector. My colleagues at the Federal Reserve and I had been watching for signs of spillover from the housing and mortgage market adjustment into other sectors of the economy, especially consumer spending. Weakening home prices, less available credit, and higher interest rates could cause a slowdown in home equity withdrawal for consumption. The reduction in overall household wealth could pull down overall household spending. Because of much of the incoming data is backward-looking, central bankers must also keep their ears to the ground to listen for changes, to identify at the earliest possible moment a change in the direction for the national economy. I rely on real-time information obtained in part from our contacts around the Southeast region. This anecdotal input is especially valuable in times of volatility and possible transition. So far, I have not seen hard or soft data that provides conclusive signs that housing problems are spilling over into the broad economy. At our August 7th meeting, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, described economic growth as moderate. At that time, the statement said, the committee's predominant policy concern remains the risk that inflation will fail to moderate as expected. This statement reflected the importance of the Fed's ongoing efforts to lean against inflation pressures. In a sequence of 17 rate hikes, the Fed increased the federal funds rate from 1% in June of 2004 to 5.25% in June of 2006, where it has since rested. I believe these efforts have yielded measurable success. Inflationary pressures have softened somewhat in recent months, and inflation expectations remain well contained. By some measures, the pace of inflation is now around 2%. In my view, current readings of inflation represent progress, but not victory. I would like to see inflation sustained at a somewhat lower rate, with emphasis on the word sustained. If inflation is allowed to accelerate, bringing it back down will be costly and painful. High and unstable inflation can distort economic decision-making, and once ratified by public expectations, is difficult to reverse. By contrast, low and stable inflation fosters an economy that's conducive to rational business activity and resistant to exogenous shocks. Looking back to a month ago, it seemed, all in all, we had ongoing economic expansion and declining inflation. Then, after our last FOMC meeting, deteriorating conditions in financial markets changed the economic outlook. On August 17th, the FOMC statement said that the downside risks to growth have increased appreciably. The balance of risk to the economy seems to have shifted. We're facing greater uncertainty in the economic outlook. Now, as you know, I'm a new central banker and a new policymaker. But I bring to this role considerable experience in the financial sector, touching on a wide range of lines of business, asset classes, and types of institutions. And I know that when a feast is occurring, there is a strong incentive for market participants to meet the competition and seek competitive advantage by pushing the, what you might call, risk-reward envelope. Some of this pushing of limits amounts to sustainable innovation. Many of these innovations served in recent years desirable ends and allocated greater risk to those investors who had the appetite for it. The subprime mortgage market has brought the American dream of home ownership to many people who previously could not qualify for mortgage loans. These developments on balance have been a good thing, but some pushing of limits, in my view, will prove to have been imprudent excess. The causes and possible consequences of the current turmoil in financial markets were discussed widely last week at the Kansas City Fed's annual conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The conference focused on housing, housing finance, and monetary policy, and was attended by central bankers, academics, financial practitioners, as well as members of the press. As expected, analysis and opinions were varied, and policy prescriptions ran the gamut from strong intervention to cautious and watchful monitoring of developments. In his remarks at the conference, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke reiterated that the Fed stands ready to take whatever action is needed. His remarks followed previous actions to inject liquidity into the financial system through open market operations and the so-called discount window. I believe the essence of our current challenge is to balance three interconnected and potentially conflicting concerns: timely action in response to risks to the total economy, preservation of gains achieved on the inflation front, and overall financial system stability. When confronted with complexity, uncertainty, and fluidity as we're now experiencing, my approach is to ground my thinking and judgments in organizing principles. Let me share with you how I think about policy in times like these. First, there is the principle of market discipline. Markets must be allowed to work. The risks and rewards of market participation should play out to the extent possible without interference. Policy should enable natural market functioning. Market participants should expect and actually experience accountability for their decisions through natural market processes. It's not the role of monetary authorities to change the risk-reward trade-off of individual instruments, individual investment instruments, or markets. Unwarranted intervention in financial markets raises concerns about what's called moral hazard. This problem could occur if investors came to believe that because of likely Fed intervention, they are immune from severe downside risk. Intervention can distort risks and create incentives to take exaggerated investment positions. Whether or not to intervene in markets is a judgment call. Although I believe Fed intervention is appropriate if markets are clearly not working properly, I am aware of the potential pitfalls of such interventions. Caution may cause some observers to argue that the central bank is insufficiently preemptive in its actions, but I believe the Fed's longer-term objectives are well served by a deliberate and measured response to financial market turbulence. Such a response should distinguish, as much as possible, between liquidity actions aimed at keeping markets orderly and monetary actions aimed at cushioning the economy from the impact of financial market instability. A second principle, however, is that the Fed has responsibility to promote financial system stability. This responsibility at times may require actions that seem to run counter to the first principle. If done effectively, there need be no conflict between actions taken to ensure the orderly functioning of markets and the principle of allowing markets to efficiently allocate gains and losses. Just last month, as investors became more and more reluctant to accept debt associated with subprime mortgages, markets began to seize up. Markets suffered liquidity, and essential transactions were not taking place. In some instances, lenders could not lend, borrowers could not borrow, traders could not trade, and accountants could not value positions. One of the Fed's tools is providing liquidity. For several successive days in mid-August, the Fed injected more liquidity through its daily open market operations. Then on August 17th, the Fed's Board of Governors announced a 50 basis point reduction in its primary credit discount rate for loans to financial institutions. This action, along with others, reduced the premium for borrowing from the central bank. Markets responded favorably to these actions, but further volatility cannot be ruled out. As the FOMC said August 17th, the committee is monitoring the situation and is prepared to act as needed to mitigate the adverse effects on the economy arising from the disruptions in financial markets. My third informing principle is sustained focus on fundamental purposes and responsibilities. In the Fed's case, these are our long-run mandates to foster maximum sustainable growth and stable inflation. I believe it's important to keep in mind the longer-run implications of policy, what happens tomorrow, the day after, and beyond. Allegiance to core institutional purpose on the part of the Fed has served the country well for many years. So to recap, my first principle is let markets work. The second principle is the central bank has a responsibility to promote orderly conditions in financial markets, stepping in as necessary to avoid severe system disruption. And the third principle is to make sure the second principle doesn't undermine our long-term mission. There are certainly tensions to be resolved in applying these principles, and formulating measured responses to circumstances requires good judgment, particularly in transitional times. I believe we are currently in such a period. So after the feast comes the dyspeptic sequelae. Fancy phrasing, but a simple notion. Housing and financial markets have feasted on a period of low rates and easy credit. I'm confident the market conditions eventually will settle down. And as we move forward, my voice in Fed deliberations will be aimed at balancing the response to immediate problems with concern for the best outcome for the long term. Mark and colleagues, thank you very much for inviting me, and I look forward to your questions.
Do you feel as though an expansion...
Would you come up and so everybody can hear?
Okay. Do you feel as though an expansion of the money supply is necessary at this time to provide better market liquidity?
Hope everyone in the back could hear the question of whether the expansion of the money supply is required this time to provide market liquidity. I'm not going to project forward from this date, but I will draw your attention to the fact that we have been doing that, and we provided, I believe it's $38 billion of market liquidity through open market operations a few weeks ago, and then, of course, the action to make the discount window more available or available and encouraged to financial institutions also provided liquidity to the market. And as stated, we will do what we feel is necessary given the conditions in the future.
how long will the housing crisis reverberate in the U.S. economy, and will we see a recession?
Who asked that question? This is one of those questions that, what kind of answer do you actually expect from a central bank? To give a sober answer, I think the housing downturn will last somewhat longer. I'm not going to put any dates on it, but I think there's more of the adjustment process that needs to unfold. And as regards the recession, I'm not, again, going to predict, but just to tell you that our objective as the Federal Reserve is to do everything possible to avoid that.
Could the Fed successfully stabilize the national financial markets in the event Iran develops and threatens to use nuclear weapons?
And this is because I moved here from Iran in 1978. Well, that's a, you know, obviously a difficult question, and it involves a reading of geopolitics that really isn't my current portfolio, so to speak. So let me answer it this way. First, I'm terribly impressed with the resilience of the U.S. economy, and for that matter, the resilience of financial markets. So if there were a serious event, I have great confidence that the country would bounce back quickly economically and the financial markets would adjust. And maybe I should just leave it at that. I'm not going to speculate on something occurring halfway around the world that could disrupt our markets. But in general, we do obviously live in a world in which all kinds of shocks are possible, and the Fed stands ready to respond to those circumstances, just as we did in 2001.
What role should the Fed play in assisting an economic recovery?
Once again, what role should the Fed play in?
In assisting an economic recovery, if that were needed.
I think the role of the Fed should stay very true to its long-term mission. And that is that the best thing we can do for economic recovery is to focus on our mission of price stability and on trying to maximize economic output, GDP, and stay focused on the medium to the long term.
Does the Federal Reserve Board monitor the relative strength of the U.S. dollar while setting monetary policy, and describe the impact on the expectation of inflation?
Question relates to the U.S. dollar. I'm going to evade that one. That's really in the portfolio of the Treasury Department, so typically Fed presidents and governors do not comment on the level of the dollar or the direction of the dollar. We do have reports on the international sector that tell us something about what has happened in recent markets, recent periods in the foreign exchange markets, as well as the economic activity or economic situation of key trading partners around the world.
Could you share some more thoughts about the lack of liquidity in the commercial paper market?
When I was a banker here in Atlanta in the 70s, late 70s and 80s, the commercial paper market was 100% a market that funded corporations. So large corporations seeking the lowest cost of funds could go to the commercial paper market and, in effect, borrow directly from investors. And as a banker, we provided what were called commercial paper backstop lines. Since that period, there's been quite an evolution in the commercial paper market. And today, about half of it, as I said in my remarks, about half of it is asset-backed commercial papers, commercial paper that is the paper is issued by structured investment vehicles and other investment funds in order to acquire short-term assets. And the liquidity in that market has dried up, partly for this reason that I mentioned, of information deficit. There have been encouraging signs in recent days that liquidity is resuming, particularly that distinctions are being made between issuers based upon the real kinds of investments they're making. So the information deficit is going from being very general to perhaps a little more specific. And that, I think, is an encouraging sign that that market is stabilizing.
Are you suggesting that this intense period of adjustment might result in stronger domestic and world economies? And if so, when and what will be the evidence?
Well, I'm long-term confident, and therefore I'm confident that as we go through an adjustment, we'll come out the other side with a strong economy. The economy to this day, it remains quite strong. World economy is growing very strongly, not entirely because of the strength of China and India, but largely because emerging markets are performing extremely well. And in general, we're facing probably one of the most benign periods of global economic growth in memory. So I'm confident that we will get through this period and we'll, along with the world economy, continue to see good growth prospects.
Much attention in the media has been devoted to how the Federal Reserve should respond to the recent turmoil in the capital markets. However, very little has been said about what the President and Congress should do pertaining to fiscal policy. Should fiscal policy be loosened through lower taxes and less regulations to abate the economy's weakness?
It's our practice to remain apolitical and not not comment on fiscal policy or on current legislation, and so I'm going to duck that question.
What is your opinion of the recent Bank of America $2 billion investment in Countrywide? Did this help the industry?
It wouldn't be appropriate, obviously, for me to comment on a particular bank or a particular investment. You know, Bank of America made that investment recently at a time which I think brought some good news to the market. We thank them for that, but it's an investment on their part, and it's not appropriate for me to comment on the wisdom of that investment.
Okay, that's all the questions.
All right. Again, to many of you in the audience, thanks for the warm welcome back to Atlanta, and I look forward, I hope, to meeting many of you over the coming months. Thanks again.
Dennis, we just want to say thank you again for coming today. The Atlanta Press Club would like to show our appreciation by making a donation to your favorite charity. We hope to see all of you again at future Newsmaker Luncheons. We'll host the Good Morning America weekend anchors on September 20th, and we'll have Clark Howard on September 28th. Don't forget to become a member of the Press Club or renew your membership. And for more information on upcoming events or membership benefits, please visit our website at atlantapressclub.org. Thank you.